Happy Wednesday. It is the Fan pregame. Justin Cuthbert, Ailish Forfar. For the next hour, we're going to chat with Carter Hutton of Daily Faceoff, go through the goaltending highs and lows to start this season in the NHL in about 10 minutes. And then Katie Heindel, our old friend, is joining us to tee up Raptors and Kings. The second time in about a week that they've played each other, and a fun one that's a little bit later on Sportsnet 1 and Sportsnet 590 The Fan, like a 10 p.m. start.
Yeah, it's a great night on the network, bolstered by Connor McDavid, of course, making the return, but the rematch, Raptors and Kings with the Drake DeMar thing kind of still in the background. It's a good time for a Sacramento-Toronto meeting, methinks.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how that might, you know, inspire some more DeMar points. We might have a ladder coming later.
It's off the truck. It's set up. It's ready to go.
Okay, good. But you mentioned it. We'll start with Connor McDavid because we've got a great game on Sportsnet a little later on tonight. That's an 8 p.m. start. Vegas and Edmonton, it'll be on after us. And Connor McDavid's back in the lineup. Initially was expected to miss 2 to 3 weeks after that weird fall into the boards. That was on October 28th. He's back. So healing quick or just eager to get back out there. But the Oilers are obviously in an important stretch of their season. Every game is an important game for the Oilers, 6-6-1. And their power play also brutal. Not as bad as the Leafs, but the Leafs now, you know, red hot with 3 goals. Mm-hmm. So McDavid hopefully getting back in there will give that team some spark. But it was a nice surprise to see that he's back on the ice.
Yeah, great on a multitude of levels, right? Great that he's going to be on a Wednesday night hockey. Great that the Oilers, kind of still treading water, are going to get him back way before they thought they were going to. And yeah, I survived his few games absence. But yeah, you want to see McDavid at full health. You don't want to see him nagging injury sort of dragging down his season, and now it's only really a speed bump on the year for him, so we can get back to projecting him in almost a full season. McDavid, what that means for, you know, his season, the Oilers season, and how we look at the entire landscape at the NHL, because of course he is the standard in the NHL. So it's good that we're going to see him back on the ice tonight. Hopefully not too soon though. I mean, it was expected to be something that could dog him for 3 weeks, and yeah, it's barely 9 days.
Yeah, and we also need him to be healed up for the Four Nations face-off. So
that is right.
So just take it easy until then. We need full ankle health. He's going to center a line with Zach Hyman and Jeff Skinner tonight on Wednesday Night Hockey. We'll have a little bit more on that, I'm sure, when we talk to Carter Hutton. But it is free agency in the MLB, and we are still getting, you know, sprinklings of information from our insiders, from those reporting on the Blue Jays. So kind of like a little charcuterie board to go through in terms of Blue Jays topics that we've uncovered today. Shout out to Ben Nicholson-Smith, who was on the J.D. Bunkus podcast today, who dropped a lot of great news. And, of course, our writers on Sportsnet.ca have put out a bunch of tidbits. Let's start with the top line here. Jays are open to moving Vladdy to third if they were to open up a spot for Pete Alonso. That one is an experiment we've seen a few times. And Pete Alonso, obviously, he can hit home runs, and he can hit the ball really well. So that's an option. And of course, our text line is always open, 590-590. If you like any of these ideas or anything sticks with you, let us know. We'll take a look through the text line a little bit later. But moving Vlad possibly to third to get a Pete Alonso at first would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think lineup manipulation is going to have to be something that, you know, any team looks at. Like even the Standard, even the LA Dodgers are apparently looking at potential lineup manipulation with Mookie Betts moving into the infield for next season, potentially, which could open up the space, I suppose, for someone named Juan Soto or any other power and impact bat that could supplement that roster. It's something you have to look at because it's not easy to inject as much talent into your lineup when everything falls into the place perfectly. So if Vlad can hang at third, if Vlad is not going to hurt you at third base, and that's one of the main avenues. That's the easiest avenue, frankly, for the Blue Jays to inject something into their lineup, because you look around all the spots that would be, you know, not necessarily nailed down by veterans or guys you're spending a lot of money on or those who are going to be a part of your future. It's hard to add there. It's hard to get a second baseman who can change the complexion of your offense. It's not as hard to find a power bat that plays one bag. So it's something definitely worth looking into. I just wonder how Vladdy ultimately feels about it, despite him saying previously that he'd be okay with it.
More from Ben Nicholson-Smith earlier on today was Blue Jays looking to be more aggressive in the starting pitcher market than the relief pitcher market and setting sights higher than Kikuchi, who I loved and you loved.
It's Yeah.
And he was great when he moved to Houston.
Don't set it too much higher than Yusei Kikuchi.
And can I get a Roki Sasaki from you?
I mean, I'd be okay with
that. Would you be interested in that?
I would definitely be interested in that. I think just the fact that they're going after a starting pitcher is interesting. Yes. Again, it feels like this is the time of year where a lot is being thrown out there, mm-hmm. and we kind of got to sift through it. But desperate times call for desperate measures with this team. I think they are going to be aggressive. And the best way to potentially aid your bullpen would be to take from the starting pitching rotation to aid said bullpen. Mm-hmm. And if they get someone who knocks everyone down and Yariel Rodriguez is not an option to start, at least on a perfect day, then maybe he can be a big portion of that bullpen to help move it in the right direction. It's probably a better option than going out there and buying up all these free agent arms that maybe not having much left. They might not have much left in terms of ammunition for in the space of a long-term deal. So I think it's probably the cleaner option. It can't be the entire strategy, but if they do add a starter, I do think it by osmosis mm-hmm. will help their bullpen.
Yeah, it looks like it would be like the premium trickle effect, as you mentioned, would be Ariel Rodriguez to begin in the bullpen. That would help with the rotation and getting somebody in there. I think they need somebody young because, like, look at the ages of Gausman, Bassett, Berríos, and, I mean, do you still have some question marks elsewhere in that rotation? They're not getting old, but they've been younger. How about that?
Sure.
Is that a nice way to put it?
Yeah, I mean,
and, you know, they put up a lot of innings for the Blue Jays over the last 2 years, like a heavy workload. And so I think it's time to look at somebody younger, like who was going to be Alek Manoah. We don't know what's going on with Alek Manoah. He was a young, perfect kind of like rotation piece to sink your teeth in. I think somebody that's got a little bit more length ahead of them is a great way to start.
And that's why Sasaki would be great, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's not a normal free agent that has already given a lot to previous teams mm-hmm. before, you know, breaking the bank potentially in free agency. Like Max Fried is another one who's out there, and mm-hmm. I don't know his age off, you know, by hand, but he's been around for a while. Certainly he's older, much older than a Sasaki.
He's 30 years old.
Would be. So you don't know with a 30-year-old, yeah, you're probably going to get a couple good years. But again, they've done that with Chris Bassett, a couple good years. Now you kind of worry about it. Same thing with Gausman. He's at the tail end of a long-term
deal. He's 33.
Deal. These guys are aging, and you don't know what you're going to get from all of them. So if you could kind of reset a little bit what your mean age is in terms of your starting pitching by bringing in someone who's at Roki Sasaki's age, I think he's 23, yeah, it could be a huge, huge boon for them.
Yeah, Berríos is 30. Chris Bassett is 35 and going to be 36.
I don't like
in
the way
February.
You said 35 that way.
Just, you know, it's a great number. Okay, so they're looking to also maybe trade.
It's a great number.
It is a great number.
Okay.
35. Blue Jays looking to trade for a controllable relief pitcher using one or more of the young position players on the bubble. And that was one of the, this is again from Ben Nicholson-Smith on the J.D. Bunkus podcast, some of his notes. The idea that there's a lot of young position players on the bubble was an exciting part of last season at times, you know, getting to see some of the young guys come up from the Bisons and have their moment. But it got to the point where there's just too many, I guess, replaceable. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but like you just have three or four guys that can fill the same role. So looking like they want to use one or more of these young position players to grab a controllable relief pitcher is the smart way to do business. Hopefully, you know, there's a lot of fan favorites out there that have come from the Bisons that have become, you know, those unsung guys you want to cheer for. Don't know exactly which ones they'd be looking for, but anyone on the bubble that can help you get a controllable right-handed pitcher, maybe to a team that's looking to kind of rebuild and get some youth in there, that looks like a way that the Blue Jays would be starting to look around.
Sure, but there's no slam dunks there. I mean, you thought no, if you're trading away Teoscar Hernandez with one more year of control that you get someone a little bit more sure thing than Eric Swanson was, and these players that we're talking about are not – and we're not Teoscar Hernandez, who did not yield much. So you're going to have to pull one over the eyes of an opposition team in order to really impact the bullpen. But you're right. There's a surplus of just bodies there, and they got to figure out who's going to be beneficial next year, who's not worth having around, and who you can parlay into something that can actually help you.
One last note. Swanson, Tate, Pop, and Romano are all legit possibilities to be non-tendered. I think the Romano thing was really interesting. He's definitely fallen off in terms of the trust tree. So we'll see where the Blue Jays go. Obviously, free agency is just beginning. We're going to have more throughout the rest of the week and into any moves that the Blue Jays do or don't make. But that was just a little bit of a sampling of some of today's headlines.
There you go.
Perfect. All right, let's shift over to some NHL talk with Carter Hutton of Daily Faceoff, former NHL goaltender himself. Carter, how's it going?
I'm doing well. I just just got off the rink with my little guy, so a quick turn and burn here, and now we're talking big boy.
Is he a goalie?
He is not a goalie. Oh. He's tried. So he plays U9, and this is the year everyone gets to try. And my wife wants no business him being a goalie. I think she saw what I went through. She didn't much care when I was a goalie, but she cares a lot more about her son being a goalie.
I've always wondered about that. Like, I was not a goalie either, and I wonder if being the wife of a goaltender or the mom of a goaltender, that's a tough situation for her to be in. So I think she's maybe choosing best.
Yeah, I don't think she cared as much when it was me, but I think now that it's her little boy, it's she's just like my mom did. I think I was in my 30s making a few million bucks a year, and my mom could still not watch. She still hated it. If someone said something bad about me, she was bothered, but it comes with the territory.
Yeah. I'm sure there won't be any regret, but if he ends up being the size of Anthony Stolarz, maybe there will be a little bit of regret, because clearly the size of Stolarz has helped him sort of emerge here with the Toronto Maple Leafs. You know, what stands out here for you when looking at this? Like, you could look at it big picture, why he wasn't in this position before, how his game has potentially changed, how he's complicated things as it comes to the, you know, the crease situation for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But as you watch this emergence, as you watch this talent shine here in, you know, one of the biggest markets in the NHL, what comes to mind for you, Carter?
You know, I think experience, right? I think just it's one of those positions where you need some time to just simmer and figure it out and understand what it takes to complete in a season and to get it done at this level. And for him, it's a good trajectory of where it was like kind of that slow burn, right? He got to this point. It didn't happen overnight. He wasn't rushed into it. There wasn't pressure. And he played in some off markets too, right? Being in Anaheim, having some time in Florida where he was protected with Bobrovsky. Now him really getting his chance to, you know, be the guy. And for me, I got to see it firsthand. I was in Minnesota on the weekend watching the Leafs and the Wild play, and the boringness to his game now that he's seen. Like, I played against Stolarz a bunch where he was busy, he chased the game, he was outside his post a lot, where now when I watch him, it's just simple. He uses his size, he reads his depth well. At times when the pucks, you know, gets to the blue line, he's getting a little more depth, but for the majority of it, there's just nothing going through him, and he makes his game simple, and it's boring to watch. And understanding how hard that is to make it boring is pretty impressive from him, and it's been fun to watch so far.
Okay, so clearly he's earned himself, I don't know about the lion's share, but he's earned himself a lot of playing time with his start, but that leaves Joseph Woll as like sort of the reactive part of that, where if you give Stolarz some, you take from Joseph Woll. What do the Leafs have to do to make sure that Joseph Woll stays on an upward trajectory, as he has been basically since he emerged on the scene in the NHL? What is crucial here for the Maple Leafs in handling Joseph Woll?
Well, health. I think the number one issue is going to be health, right? We haven't really totally seen what Joseph Woll is capable and where his ceiling is, because I still think there's a huge upside, but this is also a team that has to win now too, right? They're at a point with these guys, with their stars, with their core, they need to find a way to win. And I think Craig Berube is the guy that's going to go with the guy that's playing well. So I think strategically here is getting him set and ready to play when he gets a chance, right? Because right now, obviously the net is Stolarz. I don't think that is a question, but I also think that there's ebbs and flows of a season, right? There's going to be times where we don't know what Stolarz can do, right? He hasn't been pushed. He hasn't played 50 games. And there's a lot of wear and tear that goes into that. So I think setting Joseph Woll up for success is finding where he's at mentally, making sure he's in a good place, which he seems to always be when he talks to the media. But we all know that everyone can be a media darling, right? They can say what they need to, and who knows what goes on behind closed doors. So I think strategically for him, it's going to be good for him to be pushed. And I think this is a great problem to have for the Toronto Maple Leafs, because I wouldn't count Joseph Woll out just yet.
Yeah, they got a back-to-back starting Friday, Saturday, so we'll see him in one of those. It'll be interesting to see like how he elevates his play with a little bit of competition in the crease, which is sometimes a nice thing to have and not something often that we've had in Toronto. I'm glad you mentioned Anaheim, because I got to ask you about Lukas Dostal, which I didn't think I was going to be talking about this early into the season, but he's got 10 starts. He's leading the league in goals saved above expected, and he plays for Anaheim. And so it's like a market that we're not watching traditionally all the time. And he's a guy that I guess has come into his own. I don't know how many times you've been able to watch him, but a kid with this ability so early on, 10 starts, a .930 save percentage, and being at the top of the league, like, I guess, how exciting is it to see a new face getting a little bit of recognition and in a market that isn't traditionally winning?
You know, for me, it's exciting in the sense of he wasn't this humongous prospect coming in, right? We see guys come up all the time, and I guess maybe I'm biased toward that because I was undrafted. I kind of had to fight and claw to get myself in the door, because even at the highest level, there's politics involved, right? Who's a draft pick? Which scout is trying to protect a player? And he's battled his way in a position where John Gibson kind of was the guy there, and he's just taken the job outright from him. What I love to see here is that the World Championships, how well he played, right? He wins a championship, and now it's springboarded into this season. And he had flashes of brilliance last year during the regular season and during those World Championships. But to have a .930 save percentage in 10 games for a team that struggles defensively is very impressive. And for me, what's most impressive from the games that I've watched and the clips I've seen of him is how like low maintenance he is in the crease for a smaller guy. He's not overly, we talk about Solars being big and being able to be more methodical, let the game come to him. Lucas Dostal has to move, has to be aggressive, but it's very, he doesn't let anything go through him. He's very consistent. It's almost frustrating for a shooter where he makes it look so easy, where almost his big saves, everything's hitting him in the right position. So it's been fun to watch. Again, there's that sustainability factor on a team that gives up a lot of chances, but so far it's been very exciting for the Anaheim Ducks.
Ailish mentioned goals saved above as expected. You mentioned save percentage for a bad team. Is there like a catch-all metric that you do trust most when it comes to goaltending? Is it, you know, save percentage vis-a-vis like how your team performs defensively, or do you trust the goal saved above expected when kind of breaking down these goaltenders or trying to get a baseline on their performance?
You know, I do to a bit. I think there is a factor of the eye test. There is a factor of the situational awareness of the way the game goes and when goals are going in the times. But goals saved above expected are is your number one priority. Because I think save percentage could be, you know, diverse a bit in the sense of, like, one year I led the league, not to toot my own horn, but I played for the St. Louis Blues, where the game was, sometimes my biggest challenge was getting to the game on time, right? We were so good and so predictable defensively. And then I felt when I went to the Buffalo Sabres my first year, I had a .909 save percentage. I thought that was when I was playing my best hockey, because we were giving up so many chances and so many high quality chances, right? Where you almost have to overextend yourself. So it's really hard to get a total grasp on a goalie, you know, how good he can be and where he's at without watching games and kind of overanalyzing his play in the moment. But I think goals saved above expected would be like your best stat to go off of.
We're doing some goalie stat talk plus here on our show. We love that. I want to ask you about Canada's goalie situation, because we're going to see some of them a little later on. We got the Oilers playing on the network against Vegas tonight, and we can get into some of them. But Canada before the Four Nations face-off. This is obviously an exciting time for most people that are predicting rosters. But if you had to pick, you know, three Canadian goaltenders that would get the honor to wear the Maple Leaf, maybe no particular order, because that might be hard to determine, who are the three that you're putting on the team?
Okay, well, right now, I talked about this today as well. I think right now, if I had to pick someone who's starting for me game one, it's Jordan Binnington. I don't think that's even a question right now at this point. The way Aiden Hill has played and the way Stuart Skinner has played, it's just hasn't been as good as we expected, right? I think Skinner, we thought he's got a little bit of that Stanley Cup hangover. He's back to that inconsistent play. So for me right now, it would be Binnington, Hill, and Skinner's my outside three, I think, right now, just because of the potential he has and how his ebbs and flows of season go. But then on the outside looking in, is there's some veteran guy like a Marc-Andre Fleury who could be in that third position. If there's a guy that you want to just play in one game, he potentially could be there. You know, Sam Montembeau, you know, there was obviously that talk about him being in it. I don't think he's ready, and I don't think when the time comes to pick that team, he will be. But those would be my three, I think. Skinner, Hill, and Binnington is my starter right now if we started today.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Marc-Andre Fleury, because I was going to follow up with that. Just like the idea of a veteran of his caliber that knows how to be a professional, that's been in these situations, who's worn the jersey, and who's on his, like, way out too, right? It's a nice story. Not that we, I think Canada would love to win gold and not just have a nice story, but maybe the meshing of having both at the same time. I'm starting to warm to the idea of having him as your third goaltender, because this isn't a lengthy tournament. Doesn't even know if he's going to get a start, but I think there's a lot to be added in terms of his expertise and how he is as a teammate.
Yes, I agree. And there's so much value in the dressing room and what goes on in these short little tournaments where you need to get hot at the right time. You need to build a culture and a team. And he is a guy that can do that. And he is a guy that if he's not playing, if he's practicing, whatever he is doing, whatever his part in, he is going to be embracing it. He is going to be through and through. So I think there's value there. But I also feel like at the end of the day, you have Skinner, you have Hill, and you have Binnington, who all have, you know, cup experience. Skinner's the only one there without a Stanley Cup, but he's fresh in it. But the predictability of Skinner game is the biggest question mark for me, right? We can watch him one night, he can look great. The next night, he can be so off and so far gone from what we've seen during the playoff run when he was good. So I like that safety net as the third guy, because say something was to happen, I don't think it would be overwhelming for Fleury to get thrown into the game and be able to put up a great performance.
I don't mind it either as, like, like a kind of a demonstration for the Olympics. Like, you know, we just don't have guys that are performing at a high enough level to just be given a spot on this team. And we'd like, you know, to maybe drop the incentive and say, hey, yeah, things have got to be better for the next, I guess, 24 months when we're choosing the team that matters most, which is the Olympic team in 2026. I wonder if that'll go into the thought process as well. Barry Trotz was some interesting conversational pieces, I suppose, earlier today, threatening to, quote, start a rebuild if his team doesn't start playing better. Oof. An interesting tact. You played for Barry Trotz. What were your thoughts, given that you have some experience with Barry?
Yeah, you know, I played for Barry, and Barry was very good to me. At times, I got called out by Barry in the media, you know, saying it wasn't good enough. And I think a challenge, right? Behind closed doors, what went on with me and Barry. But he was great. I think he was a guy, for me, it was very black and white and helped me motivate myself to be successful. But I also feel like they are in this position because of who they brought in, right? You bring in three skilled players who want the puck that are all right-handed shots, and you don't really have a disher to get them the puck, right? These are guys that want to shoot the puck and play that way. So I feel like they're trying to find lightning in a bottle here with that third line, second line center. It just hasn't really worked out. And again, when I watched them play, especially last night, you hear Ryan O'Reilly's comments just about how poor he played and how things are going. It seems very disheartening where they're at right now. And I feel like they're grasping at straws. Like, they talk about going on the road and trying to find their identity here, get away from home. And that's kind of lip service, right? They need to go and they need to play the game that they need to play, right? They didn't just become this ultra skilled team that's going to win teams with amazing offense, right? They need to find a way to grind it out and get back to their 5-on-5 play. And I think for Barry Trotz, he's just being honest, right? I guess this is kind of a threat to the players, because I'm sure they've had some meetings along the lines here, but where they're sitting right now in the Central, this far behind Winnipeg, something's got to give in Nashville, because this is unacceptable.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, he kind of told that himself. He's like, we were playing fantasy hockey over the summer. If you're playing fantasy hockey, you might be running into some problems, because I don't think you build Stanley Cup winners through fantasy hockey, but we'll see if that latest bit of motivation can help the Predators. Last one for you. An old teammate, Shea Weber, going to the Hockey Hall of Fame this weekend. For you, what makes him a Hall of Famer?
Oh, everything. This is a guy like the ultimate leader. You know, not that he, like the way he just held everyone accountable and how he led as a leader was unbelievable. I think a guy I was so fortunate to play for, my first real full years in the league was in Nashville with Shea Weber, Mike Fisher, Pekka Rinne, these guys that are just like the ultimate teammates. And it felt like we would get the oddball player who maybe was in trouble on other teams. We would sign, they would play for us, and they fell in line because of the way Shea Weber carried himself. And he was a guy, I remember one time Philip Forsberg scored a goal to make it 6-1 in a game, and he shot the stick down, you know, like the shoots the sword down. And right away, Shea Weber jumps the board, skates down to him and says, grabs him and says, like, you don't ever do that again. And that was kind of the thing. Like, we're here to win, but we're not going to embarrass our teammates. We're going to win the right way. And just the way he carried himself on and off the rink, I, you know, proud of him and, you know, a great friend and a guy that I don't think if he played hockey, probably could have played in the NFL. He was just one of those guys that was just a genetic freak and obviously impressive what he'd done in his career.
I love that. It's always exciting to hear from former players when they're going in the Hall of Fame. Like, your perspective is much different than the stats and us watching the clips. So it's a good one. We'll be reflecting on his legacy over the next couple of days. Carter, we appreciate you jumping on. Enjoy the kiddos on the ice and we'll chat soon.
I will. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Carter Hutton, Daily Faceoff, former NHL goaltender. What do you think of the Trotz thing? Whew.
Yeah.
There's lots going on in that town.
I do. It is interesting because how guys approach not even first, I guess mostly first jobs, but not necessarily first jobs. This is definitely a different experience for Barry Trotz jumping into the executive seat. And he does it without like the, well, I got to take it slow here because I want to be employed as long as possible. He's kind of a legend in Nashville. Yeah. He can call his own shots. And I guess the first play for him was like, let's just go for it. And if I have to rebuild, I have to rebuild. I think that is an interesting tact. You know, threatening it over a team, like this is a bunch of grownups, right? Like, oh, we're going to start a rebuild. It's kind of like, you know, you're dealing with a five-year-old where it's like, I'm going to take this away. If you're not going to do it this way, I'm going to have to take the toy away. Like, that's kind of juvenile. And yet, I don't know. It might just work, but it's crazy enough that it just might work. What do you think?
I think, I think between him and Ryan O'Reilly, who said he had the worst hockey game of his life, I forget his exact words, but it was the most embarrassing performance. Between those two comments over the last two or three days, it's clearly dire. And it's almost like they're both trying to do their own tactic to spark something with this team. Obviously, if you're Barrett Trotz, you can say what you want behind, you know, closed doors or in the locker room. But this is a very public call out. It was on a radio station. It's obviously making headlines, and we're talking about it. And then for Ryan O'Reilly to like put all that right there out there in the media after a game that he performed poorly, and like, you know that Ryan O'Reilly is going to have the best game of his life next time, right? Like, he called himself out. He said, that was on me. And then you think, okay, well, next game, he's bringing it. So maybe there's something about some of the public voices saying that this isn't acceptable, but it's all going to be the next game, right? The next time around the ice. Like, are you responding to that? And I think we'll learn a lot about the internal, I guess, leadership, because they added a lot of guys with some leadership capabilities. Stamkos, Marchessault. Like, those guys are coming in, they're already leaders, and maybe it's just been a lot of different voices, but now you're setting the expectation, whether you're Ryan O'Reilly or you're Barry Trotz, like, this is not good enough.
They come with leadership, but they also come with term. So I don't know how easy it is going to be to rebuild when you've got Philip Forsberg until 2030 making $8 million, $8 million to Stamkos till 2028, Marchessault $5.5 million till 2029, $4.5 million for three more years for Ryan O'Reilly, Tommy Novak making $3.5 million for three more years, three defensemen, with at least 3 years and $4 million in terms of the contract length. And of course, UC Saros gets paid $7.7 million till 2033. It's going to be hard to just be like, oh, rebuild button, press it. Like, I don't know how that's actually even possible. So they may not be able to, like, they may not take that seriously because they know this isn't a rebuild. They know they're kind of locked in with a lot of money and a lot of guys who are part of that fantasy hockey, who aren't going anywhere anytime soon.
And they play tonight against the red-hot Washington Capitals. So it kind of gets serious quick here. Predators 4-7-1, Capitals 8-3-0. And the exact quote from Ryan O'Reilly was, "I know for myself I'm extremely frustrated. That was probably, I think, one of the worst games I've ever played. I was pathetic." I hope you never say that after a show, Justin.
That's a guy.
But
who
I hope
wants...
you can hold yourself accountable if we have a pathetic show.
He's had good quotes. Didn't he say he fell out of love with hockey in Buffalo?
Like,
I guess he's brutally honest at the lowest points. But yeah, Predators got to turn around. I don't know if Washington's the team to allow it though.
No, they're red hot. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Katie Heindel will join us on the other side. We're going to go through Raps and Kings. A fun one. Just 4 days ago, Raptors won in overtime. Was like the Raptors are the Kings, well, there you go, of covering the spread. It's a big one. It's 11 tonight. We'll see if
you got to keep that a secret. We can't be saying that.
Well,
too loudly.
I'm going to say it now. I'm going to say it later. My best bets because they're 7-1 against the spread. So
just cover,
baby. That's their motto this year. Just cover. No, I think they have.
Honestly, if that's the motto, if that's what they do better than anyone else, you know you're going to have competitive
games.
Right, you know
you're
going to be feeling good about a lot, but you know you're going to be in the sweepstakes Cooper Flagg AL. So it's actually not the worst thing in the world.
That's the new motto of the Toronto Raptors. But we'll go through more with that with Katie Heindel on the other side of the break.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkin Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on the Fan pregame, Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590, The Fan on after us. You got to wait till about 9:30 for the pregame show here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, or the game beginning at 10 o'clock. It'll be on Sportsnet 1. In the meantime, you can watch the Wednesday night hockey, Vegas Edmonton, 8 p.m. start on Sportsnet. And, of course, a lot of games available on Sportsnet Plus tonight.
Yeah, good one. Raptors, rematch, a little backstory. Edmonton getting Connor McDavid back. Mm-hmm. Great night on the network.
All right, let's tee it up with our friend Katie Heindel, Basketball Feelings, Substack, and many more. Katie, we appreciate you jumping on. How are you?
My friend, it's been so long. I'm great.
You're writing a book now? Like, you're too busy.
I know. A gift and a curse. No, thank you for having me.
Of course. We're excited. You know what? We're trying to decipher this Raptors identity, and I was writing down a couple, like, buzzwords. Fun, fast, unexpected. And I think, like, that's maybe why I'm enjoying watching them, is because I didn't really know if I was going to enjoy basketball from the Raptors. I didn't really know who was going to shine, and then they had all these injuries. But I'm really enjoying watching the Raptors kind of gut it out and have a little bit of feistiness to them and keeping games close. I actually think that I've enjoyed watching the Raptors more than I have in a couple seasons so far to start this year.
I mean, I think you nailed it. And I also think those three words are kind of my favorite way to watch a team, especially a young team, you know, where the pressure's off. I mean, injuries aside, which I'm sure we'll get to, it just feels like there's so much more clarity going into this season about direction, about expectations, you know, is a trickle down from that, about the kind of like developmental arcs and how they're pretty complementary to one another on this team. And also just this, what we're witnessing, I think, throughout the first few games of the season is just these like real time, almost unlocking or discoveries, I think, of skill from guy to guy, especially as they're kind of fitting into the rotation ad lib, given, you know, the injuries. But yeah, I do love like a frenetic basketball game that's a little bit like you always have this feeling of like, is this going to go off the rails? I mean, they're not going off the rails, but it makes it so much more fun to watch.
It seems like Grady Dick's sort of central to everything you were laying out there. The sophomore development, how he's now leading his draft class in points per game. It's been a really, really encouraging start for Grady Dick. It seems like massive for the short-term future of this franchise that he becomes what I guess they set out for him to eventually become.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still humming kind of after that chase down block that he got off in Denver. That was great to me because it also shows this added layer of confidence that I think Grady Dick came into this season with. You know, he's the youngest Raptor to ever score 20 or more points over four consecutive games. Mike Brown, who will be seen again tonight, said he's, you know, he ought to be in the running for most improved player. All that stuff is pretty exciting, but I did want to zero in. Eric Kareen had a really great story at The Athletic after the Nuggets game. He spoke with Garrett Temple, you know, about Grady's development. And Temple mentioned that, you know, when Emmanuel Quickley and Scotty Barnes get back, it's not going to be such a dramatic adjustment for Grady to be able to slip back as a third or fourth option, because if anything, this stretch now and that shift is going to help accelerate his development even further because, you know, as I mentioned before, we're seeing this real-time leveling up with Grady, I think, on everything from explosive defense, as I mentioned, to this really confident shooting, and not just shooting from anywhere. You know, he's picking his spots, he's making sure he gets good looks, and I think that kind of creation was out of his depth last season, and he also just wasn't being asked to do it. So I think all of this has shown, one, again, like how much he's leveled up, but also how he can be a key for this team, because, you know, the one trickle down effect of all of this too is the added space that it's created, because now defenders are, they're either drifting to him or they're targeting him outright, and it's freeing up guys like RJ Barrett and Davion Mitchell, you know, to take shots. And I think overall it's created this less rushed offense. So again, like, these are things that we didn't expect from Grady Dick this season, because, you know, this isn't what the role was going to be for him starting out, but to see him be able to step into something like this so willingly and confidently, I don't know, it's very exciting.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're a gambling girl, but our listeners often are. He's leading in the odds to be the most improved player of the year. And I wonder for you, like, I mean, this is obviously a small sample size, but traditionally, someone that wins like most improved player, do they have to be an all-star? Do they have to, you know, continue this specific amount of points per game? Like, that would be pretty amazing if Grady Dick was most improved player. And tied in odds with him is RJ Barrett. So obviously teams and players that underperformed are getting this love, but I just was shocked to see that he's like the leading candidate right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I think with you, like, I wouldn't consider someone like Grady Dick like a candidate for, honestly, just because of age initially. I think of most improved, and I kind of put it on almost like in the sixth man category, right?
Right,
in the NBA, like someone who's been around for a long time and then maybe has to switch up their skill set due to, you know, where they've ended up, trades, things like that, or just having to kind of change their game in order to have longevity in the league. But with Grady, to be able to do this so quickly, and I think, again, to like take on all these new traits so willingly and to really like sort it out in real time. I mean, I did watch him at Summer League, and just like the added size and kind of physicality was an early clue that he would be able to do this. But the mental part, you can't know, you know, until the season gets rolling, until you're asked to take on this new role. So I think that's something that kind of gets missed when we talk about most improved. We more look at numbers, right? And how these kind of things shake out. But the fact that he's been able to quite calmly and willingly and honestly, like, also looks like he's having a ball doing it, I think is like a pretty fair indicator that he should be in the running for something like that.
Yeah, it does make sense. But also, like, with young guys, it's like, oh, that's like the natural trajectory of, you know, a rookie to a sophomore. Like, that's how they're supposed to, you know, introduce themselves to the NBA, a little bit of a progression, maybe a jump from year one to year two, the same 2 to 3. And when generally the guys who get this award, like Tyrus Maxey, I think it was last year, where it's like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm an all-star now. I've been in the league for a couple of years, but this is my jump. We'll see if Grady continues to get the credit, though, in that regard. One of the old tropes, Katie, is that, you know, defense is just like work rate. Like, if you want to be a good defensive team, you just got to work hard. And I feel like, you know, this Raptors team is not a team that's not working hard. So it does feel like it's a bit of a fallacy there. But what to you is preventing them from being a little stronger defensively, yielding a lot of points early in the season? And maybe that's part of the process. Maybe that's just part of, like, hey, this is what we're focusing is on, being fluid offensively and making sure we're, you know, we're starting with that. But if the Raptors get more stops, it leads to more wins here.
Turnovers really strike me as like the major thing. Last time I checked, they were either leading or neck and neck with the Pistons, with something like 17.4 or 5 per game. You know, that kind of, if we're talking about offensive, we're talking about defense, but that kind of like offensive bleeding out really does drain the energy on that end of the floor. And I think it then disrupts the momentum to get back at the other end that they rely so heavily on, you know. And I mean that, like, because they are a young team, they are shorthanded. Momentum is really critical for them to win games. And we've seen them kind of, that's where they can tip the scales on the games that they've taken at this point in the season. So, you know, that is a little bit indicative of them playing as fast and kind of free and loose. As we talked about earlier, turnovers are going to be a part of that. But I would like to see them clamp down on that. And, you know, Darko has certainly talked about it. I think this Kings game tonight will be sort of a good test for it, and also a good test for Darko's rotations to see which kind of combinations he can go for. It'll be more a game of, I think, longevity and playing a bit of a long game and tamping down on energy and trying to stay consistent, which, again, that is a pretty big defensive ask, I think, for a young and a little bit short-handed team. But this is what the games to me seem to be for so far this season, is every game is a little bit different. You're going to learn a little bit more. It's kind of like we're learning along with the team, which is what makes it more exciting to watch them this season.
Our Daniele Franceschi here had a great tweet that I'm stealing a stat from. Raptors have yielded 30-plus points in the fourth quarter 7 times this season, which is most in the NBA. So closing games, clearly not a strong suit of this, you know, young and chippy team. And I wonder if you start to draw a correlation with someone like a Jakob Poeltl, who's had some foul trouble late in games, and someone like that defensive discussion that we're having, how they can tighten that up, because it's, you know, we've seen the opposite where the Raptors have, they're that fake comeback team, but mm-hmm. I don't want them to be the team that loses every fourth quarter either. So, like, how do you fine tune that specific part of closing games and having that attention to detail when it comes to the fourth quarter?
I think it does have a lot to do with experience, honestly. I think, you know, when these guys get on a run, it's tough. And you kind of see it going through the roster. It's tough to make them almost settle and realize, like, okay, now you've got the run. You've got to hang on to it, but you still have to play really dynamic basketball. You've got to move the ball. If anything, you've got to move it more than you have been to try and keep it, especially with how they're playing and those turnovers I mentioned earlier. Poor Jakob. I do feel he's just getting kind of singled out just because of his size with the team. Like, we haven't seen Chris Boucher there, you know, in that role as much. And I think there's probably some level of fatigue. Like, teams are just really going after him because I do think they see him as, like, okay, not that he's a mark, but he's sort of like where the leak can happen, especially in the paint, because he doesn't have a lot of help, you know? So I think, that's why I'm sort of curious to see how the defensive rotations may change with this road trip. You know, they almost had it against the Lakers, and the Lakers do have size, so they'll be seeing them pretty soon as well. So I'm curious to see how that rematch goes. But yeah, it's almost like, if I could use like the analogy, it feels a little bit like a house of cards. Like, they spend mm-hmm. 3.5 quarters sort of building it up, and then somebody just kind of nudges one, and it all comes toppling down.
Let's shift gears a little bit. Around the league, there's some notable records. The Cavaliers 8-0, Thunder 7-0, Bucks 1-6, Sixers 1-5. Of those four, which is like the realest? Which is most interesting to you? Which stands out as wow?
The Cavs to me are the realest. Granted, I wouldn't have put them on this hot of a start, but the fact that they're all healthy and started this season like this, this was kind of the Cavs team I wanted to see throughout last season's playoffs. And I think it's the team they thought they could have been, you know, had Jared Allen not gone down. But, like, they are such a fun and phenomenal team to watch. If you want to talk about fast, but also really, like, fast and cohesive, you know, they just play, they're so confident. It's so much fun watching them. They have this they've also like been through the trenches together a little bit. So I think there's like an intuitiveness that kind of runs through that roster that Donovan Mitchell has fit into so seamlessly, you know, especially with over the off season, you know, there being rumors of maybe this guy's not happy there. Maybe he wants to leave. It really seems like they've moved past that. And I think Kenny Atkinson is like a huge, huge part of it. It's kind of interesting to say I don't feel that it's fake with either the Sixers or the Bucks. Like, I'm legitimately there. It's hard for me to find a silver lining for either of those teams right now, I think, which is tough because I do really like that Sixers team. We talked about Maxey a little bit earlier. Tyrese Maxey is kind of carrying them now, which is a lot to ask for. And the Bucks, it feels almost existential at this point because I don't think this is just a case of Giannis's injury, Dame's injury. Like, this is something that's bled over from almost the beginning, I think, of last season. And I don't know whether that's pressure, expectation. I'm not sure, but you would assume that two guys at that level, if there is any hiccups, it is part of their job with their experience, you know, and being the leaders of that team to be able to smooth it out. And from everything I've heard, you know, on the surface, the two of them get along. Giannis made a lot of space for Dame. He kind of adjusted his game to fit Damian Lillard's. So that one is a real question mark for me.
Thank goodness then for the Cavs, because the Bucks and Sixers were supposed to be two of the teams that could actually you know, hang with the Celtics. And we can't rely exclusively on the New York Knicks to potentially stop the Celtics to getting back to an NBA Finals and potentially a back-to-back title this season. I want to give you a chance to reflect on the Vince stuff. Vince Carter retired last weekend at Scotiabank Arena. What did that mean to you?
Oh, I mean, that was a great press conference. I was crying along with him. No, I think, you know, as someone who I never felt as betrayed, you know, personally as some people did. And, you know, I came up in that era of Raptors basketball, you know, but I was also at that 2014 Grizzlies game when you could feel the energy turning in the arena, you know, in real time. And I've had the great opportunity to interview Vince a few times now. And he's always so gracious and very reflective. So I was sort of curious to see how he would come into not just the retirement ceremony, but all the events that have led up to it, you know. And I did get an opportunity to ask him that in the presser, of just like, he talked about wanting to stay in the moment and wanting everybody present to stay in the moment. But the moment for him has changed so many times, you know, because all of this really started back in September, you know, with the public court dedication to him and when it was announced that the team would be retiring his jersey. So it's like, this is a hard thing for a person to really grasp what's happening to them and, you know, the momentousness of it. And I think he's been so truthful and like really genuine and expressive throughout everything. And he certainly was at the presser. I have like a sad admission to make. My friends threw a belated birthday party for me that night, so I did not stay.
Ooh, happy belated. Sorry.
Okay, I watched it the next day and teared up again, but it was very special to be there early, and you could just kind of feel the energy for it. And I think it's so rare to have some kind of like a full circle, you know, culmination like that for any athlete. But certainly I think, you know, if you want to talk about Toronto sports, right, we don't necessarily get these happy endings like that. And I think this one was really chosen. Like, certainly it was an honor that the Raptors wanted to bestow on him. But I do think Vince, you know, obviously had to agree to it, you know, and it just really seems like this is the one that he wanted all along. And I can understand that because it does put a certain amount of, you know, things to rest and a certain chapter to rest. And it is where he got his start, like for good or for ill. It's where he made, you know, a name for himself. So it's rare to see these sort of full circle things in sports. And I think we can often take them for granted. So it, genuinely, it was just a very, it was a very special thing to be a part of.
It sounded like you had lots of basketball feelings, which is very fitting for you.
The most feelings.
The most fitting for you. Well, we appreciate you jumping on. It's been a while. Glad to have you back. Glad to have basketball back. And so we'll get teeing up Raps and Kings and enjoy tonight's game. Katie, we'll chat soon.
Thanks so much, guys.
It's Katie Heindel, Basketball Feelings Substack. And check out her work there. She's also writing a book. And we got both those undefeated teams, Cavs and Thunder, playing tonight. Which team loses first? Cavs are playing the Pelicans, who are 3-5. OKC's playing the Nuggets, who are 4-3.
Ooh, it's a tougher challenge tonight for the Thunder, I think, because the Pels are down a few bodies.
And it's in Denver.
I think the Cavaliers lose first, though.
Okay.
I think they both win tonight.
We'll have Cavs, to take a look.
Cavs run into something eventually.
All right. Well, that leads us into...
Thunder team's a wagon.
Yeah, I know. They're your favorite.
They're so good.
They are your favorite team. Okay, so let's take a look at some best bets for tonight. I've got the Raptors to cover 11.5. They just played this team the other night, went to overtime. Mentioned it earlier in the show. The Raptors are 7-1 against the spread. Just think that they're keeping games close and fun, and they're playing with pride. Like, they just might be the just cover baby team. So I'll take that. And then also tonight, the rivalry series begins with Canada, United States women's hockey. It's going to be 5 games this year. Usually, traditionally, it was 7. So I have Canada, USA going to overtime, +320. These guys always go to overtime. That's like they love going to overtime or having a game that's like 2-1 or 3-2. So I'm going
to not fair for me to ask you off top of the hand, but last rivalry series, how many overtime games do you think?
3.
That's the bet,
that was crazy.
100%. That's the bet.
The thing that just tells you how close these two teams are, is the last two rivalry series, which are just between Canada and United States as a way to tee up for the World Championships, Canada started down 0-3 on both of the last two rivalry series and then reverse swept both of the last rivalry series. So if you want to go tradition, Canada loses tonight, they lose the next two, and then they reverse sweep. But it's always close with these two teams. This is the first time that they're going to match up. It's only a 5-game series, so I think it's going to be incredibly tight. Tonight's in San Jose, Utah on Friday, Idaho on Sunday, and then they play 2 games in Canada, in Halifax and in PEI, which I really want to go to. That's a special place for me. February. So I don't know if I want to go to PEI in February, but I would still do it. So they play 5 games. I'm going to pick Canada, USA overtime tonight just for some fun.
Yeah, I think you got to play it every game, though.
Plus 320.
Happens a couple times, you're well in the money. And you're right. If they keep double-digit Raptors in terms of the points they're going to give us, we probably have to eat it up. I'll go the other way, though, at least in terms of point scoring for DeMar DeRozan. The ladder, of course, is out. It's in the studio. It's ready to be climbed. DeRozan, a little aggrieved, maybe at the Raptors, or at least one member of the Raptors executive team, kind of-ish, in Drake. 30 points is +250, 35 +700, a 40-burger for DeMar DeRozan tonight, 15-1.
Worth so the ladder sprinkle. Is we had 33 last time, right?
On DeMar DeRozan.
There you go.
Also, the Capitals hosting, I believe, the Predators.
Yes.
The Predators, you know, they're being threatened with, hey, we're going to start a rebuild. I think this is double-cross territory. The Capitals are just a good team. I don't think, it's kind of childish. We talked about it, a little juvenile. I don't know if you're going to be like, oh, the Predators is our best effort now against a really good team in the Capitals. So I like Capitals at a short number, -120. And I kind of feel like it's another one against the narrative. Vegas +135 with Connor McDavid coming back. Ooh. What happened when Laura Stacey came back to the lineup for you? It was like, okay, finally, Laura Stacey's back. We can kind of put it in neutral.
That's true.
I feel like you might get a response.
Let her take the reins.
Vegas at +135. Like, I'll play it every single time against anyone. +135 for the Golden Knights. So busy night tonight. And speaking of basketball feelings, Christian Koloko will be in the Lakers rotation tonight.
That's
returning
awesome
to basketball after 18-month process, getting back from a blood clot issue that definitely, derailed his young career after he was drafted by the Raptors. So it'll be cool to see Christian Koloko back on an NBA floor tonight.
Definitely. That's wonderful news. You know, he was really, I think everybody really liked him in the Toronto organization. It's too bad it didn't work here, but great to see him back on a court. So have our eyes on that one, Christian Koloko and the Lakers. Okay, so we got lots to go through tonight. We teed it up, Raps and Kings, a rematch of like a week ago. That's at Mm-hmm. 10 p.m. on Sportsnet 1, and you can listen to it here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Our pregame show will start at 9:30. And we want to tune into Vegas and Edmonton, our big Wednesday night hockey game. That's at 8 o'clock. That'll be a good one. We got lots of good sports on Sportsnet Plus as well. You can browse through picking of NHL games tonight.
Indeed. It's a good night. Sportsnet, Vegas, Edmonton. Like, that's... Vegas Edmonton's one of these special games. So excited for that on Wednesday Night Hockey.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow. It's Baby Friday. Looking forward to it. We'll see you then. Have a good night.